Hello and welcome to CoatyCast, the podcast for discussion, debate and analysis of issues related to geriatric and general medicine.
And today we've got Vicky and Christina joining us, so hello both of
hello.
You.
Hello.
Hi.
And this is the fourth episode in our new kind of series of top tips and things that we've learnt this week, whether it's from the wards, teaching or from Twitter. So I'm going to be doing a top tip about C. diff today, and the reason I'm doing it is because I always get a bit confused when patients' results come back as GDH positive and toxin negative. So I thought I'd have a quick look about that and about a few things around C. diff. So reading around it, 25% of C. diff is community acquired. So actually we need to think about it for patients who are coming into hospital with diarrhea and not just patients who are developing diarrhea in hospital. There's two different types of tests you can do. You can do screening tests using PCR or glutamate dehydrogenase testing, which is GDH. And then that's testing to see if you're a carrier of C. diff. So it's a detection of C. diff bacteria. And then you can test the stool for toxin. So if you have a C. diff toxin in your stool and you're symptomatic with diarrhea, then you've got a C. diff infection. If you've got C. diff bacteria by PCR or GDH, the C. diff toxin might be negative or equivocal, and it might not represent disease. So if you end up with a patient's results coming back as GDH positive, toxin negative, it could usually mean one of three things. Firstly, they're colonized with non-toxic C. diff. They're not symptomatic, and they don't have C. diff infection. Number two, they do have C. diff infection, but the toxin level is too low to be detected because it's not a particularly sensitive test. So in these patients, you should do a further stool sample to see if the toxin level has increased. And number three, you might have a non-viable C. diff. So that means patients who have had C. diff and the infection and have been treated, the test can remain positive for 6 to 8 weeks after they've completed the treatment. And that's why you don't do further stool samples to check for clearance after treatment, because it can remain positive for up to 8 weeks afterwards. So I thought that was just a quick top tip about what those results mean, because I always get confused about it.
Yes, me too. No, that was good to know. Thank you.
Yeah,
sounds... I do get very confused, and I don't really understand what it means when they come back. So,
and often it's when the nurses asking us to clarify the results to them.
And I was surprised at how many is community
acquired. Yeah, that's really interesting, because you think you'd have to be like close proximity to, you know, lots of people in an institution. Interesting.
I know. Right. So who's
shall
next?
I go next?
You go next.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, Christina.
So recently we have had a patient on the ward who we've diagnosed with alcohol-related cirrhosis, and he is encephalopathic. So this made me think, how often do we overlook encephalopathy or alcohol withdrawal or intoxication as a cause of delirium in our elderly patient group? So my top tip for this CoatyCast is to always ask an alcohol history. I wondered how often as doctors we might miss alcohol problems in the elderly, whether it's patients not bringing it up or we don't ask about it, whether the effects of alcohol are mistaken for a physical or a mental health problem, or whether we forget that the older population can have concealed drinking problems too. So I had a little look around some of the figures to do with drinking and change over recent decades. And it's now 1 in 5 older men and 1 in 10 older women are drinking harmful amounts, which surprised me. They were higher figures than I thought. And that's a 40% increase in men and 100% increase in women in the last 20 years. And a third of people with drinking problems develop them in later life. So I thought those are all quite interesting statistics very important to ask as part of, I usually ask it in the social history, unless it's quite evidently part of the presenting complaint. So of course we know that the effects of the same amount of alcohol in a younger person are enhanced in an older person, and the elderly break down alcohol more slowly, are more sensitive to the effects. They're more likely to lose their sense of balance and of course more likely to fall. And finally, medication interactions are also more likely. So along with falls and polypharmacy and other elderly care issues, it can be a significant problem. So that's my top tip.
I think you're right. I think we do overlook it.
Absolutely. I'm very guilty of doing that, actually. I think I often, you look at somebody and because they don't look like your typical alcoholic, you don't really ask it. And I think it's important to remember, as you say, those patients who just drink regularly and steadily, but over the recommended limit.
And they don't think that it's abnormal amounts, so they don't think to offer it as a problem, or it's concealed from family and friends if you're getting a collateral history and you know, they don't actually know about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes you're right, we might ask the question, but we don't clarify the amount. So the kind of elderly lady who says, oh, I'll enjoy a glass of wine with dinner, but you don't kind of clarify, you just think,
I find it hard to get people to quantify the amounts as well. They're very vague and, you know, how long does it take you to finish a bottle of whatever? And you don't always get a consistent answer, do you? Including in people that don't have drinking problems, people find it very difficult to off the cuff really think about how much they do drink.
Yeah, and I think I also sometimes like feel a bit guilty for asking. Mm-hmm. It's kind of awkward, and I feel like you know, they should be in my head. I'm like, oh, they should be allowed a drink. So why am I trying to make them feel bad about it? And
unless they're falling over every time, or falling up down outside the pub every evening.
Well, exactly. So you know, I tend not to quantify it sometimes because I'm almost embarrassed to ask, which, you know, I shouldn't be really.
Yeah.
Right. Who's next?
So speaking of falling over after a few pints, I just wanted to actually touch on geriatric trauma. So this is becoming a really big thing now at the front door. And a lot of emergency departments are taking real specialist interest in geriatric trauma. And that's because we see so much of it. And also it's really important. And there's a couple of reasons for that. So the elderly are much more susceptible to injury from a minor mechanism. And the most common trauma to an elderly person is actually a simple fall from a standing height. But they're much more likely to get fractures of their spine, their ribs, their hips, and also their extremities. But because they tend to have a diminished functional residual capacity, it means that often they're less able to tolerate the injury. So, for example, if they had rib fractures, they would suffer from sort of worsened hypoxia, or the effects of the hypoxia might be worse on them. For example, they might become delirious just by being slightly hypoxic. They're more at risk of pneumonia. And I think part of the problem is that they're often under triaged. So you see lots of elderly patients sat in the ED with ambulance crews waiting to be seen. And often because their OBS are okay, they're actually prioritized down the list, so they're often a category 3 or a category 4. And I think what we have to remind ourselves is that traditional physiological parameters don't really help in the elderly. So we all know from the wards that often the new score doesn't necessarily reflect how ill a patient is. And I think it's really important to remember that, you know, looking at the heart rate, the blood pressure in somebody who's sustained trauma, an elderly patient, doesn't always factor in just how sick they are. So my learning point from this really is the key is to sort of continually reassess them, make sure there's no change. And most emergency departments have trauma guidelines now to follow, which are often up on the walls in the middle of the emergency department. But for those juniors also working in a ward-based environment, we've got to think about this, especially if patients have falls as well. So really important to remember that you must assess every fall thoroughly and must fill in a falls protocol, which will help prompt you. And I also just wanted to highlight there's a Hector course running at James Cook, and we'll put a link into this. It's actually a 2-day training course up in the northeast of England, and they've pioneered this elderly care trauma that's tied in with the geriatricians and also the emergency department. And it's about a sort of holistic approach to elderly trauma. Really, really good agenda if anyone fancied going to that.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
I might look into it.
Yeah. Well, it's very accessible to anyone, but it's just really to highlight that, you know, we need to just take a step back and have a real think if we come across even elderly patients with minimal trauma.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And from quite a lot of our teaching recently, it's been flagged up as well. Do they call it silver trauma? Seems to be the tagline, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
And of course, you always forget that the most innocuous of injuries and falls can obviously cause so much more in the frailer osteoporotic generation.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Fall from standing height can do a lot more damage than you would expect.
Yeah,
that's true. I suppose that's why it's not flagged up. The history doesn't sound of a severe traumatic event, you know, like falling from a ladder or a car crash or something. That's good top tip, Vicky.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another?
Yeah, well, and you guys know how much I am not a fan of Twitter. I've only got about three Twitter friends, or whatever you call them. Well, yeah, I can't use it.
I think I might have more friends in the week I've been on it.
Thanks, Christina. Well, I hope you're my friend on Twitter. Get my numbers up.
It's my new snazzy name.
Yeah.
I think Emma's actively rejecting people.
Well, anyway, I was browsing on Twitter the other day because this group has made me, and I came across this tweet by @DrShibley. I just thought it was quite interesting. So he has written, "The thing you notice about the way people talk about dementia as a care partner is that everything suddenly has different names. So holiday becomes respite, walking becomes wandering, mm-hmm. moving becomes mobilizing, and so on." And loads of people have commented on it and said, you know, going to the toilet becomes, are you toileting yourself? And placement, so people don't live anywhere, they're placed somewhere, they're placed in a nursing home, or they become service users rather than kind of patients. I just thought it was quite interesting, and we're kind of medicalizing this, these kind of words, and depersonalizing our approach to dementia patients. And I just thought probably highlighted that we should kind of consider our language quite carefully, because I know that I'm guilty of this and saying things like that. And
yeah, absolutely. No, it's really interesting. Making me think about what sort of terminology.
And I think
we don't mean it, do we?
We don't mean to. But
no.
And we're so,
no,
but
it's not meant to be discriminatory.
I suppose if you were on the other side and you were the family or the patient listening, you might feel.
I think it's more about speaking to family and patients, because obviously, you know, jargon we use all the time in hospital and in our MDTs and stuff, we probably will keep using this, but maybe when we're speaking to family members, it's maybe a bit more important to consider the way we teach it and our phrasing.
Yes, it's like with everything, isn't it?
Yeah, we wouldn't use overly medical terminology to them when we could help it with other things.
Yeah, and you don't.
I was just saying, I just thought that was quite an interesting tweet.
It was. A point to reflect on.
So I think that's all of our top tips this week. So thanks so much for listening. You can find the podcast on iTunes or on our website, which is www.aeme.org.uk. And we're going to put all the useful links up on there as well. And if you have anything that you want to tweet us, any of your own top tips, then give us a tweet at Elderly Med Ed. So thanks so much.